From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For Congress, a 60-day clock started ticking yesterday on an up or down vote on the Iran nuclear deal. Opinions are all over the place. The president has a veto. It looks likely to go through. What about Iran? There's a range of views there, too. Journalist Robin Wright has been in the middle of it all and of the behind-the-scenes negotiation story out of Vienna. This hour on Point, Robin Wright on the negotiations, the deal, and the view from Iran. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Has Iran changed? Will it? Should this deal go forward? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Robin Wright. She's been covering Iran since 1973, has been to Iran more than any other American journalist since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. She's still reporting, also a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center. She was in Tehran in May most recently, and as talks ground on in Vienna, she managed to secure exclusive inside access to both the American and Iranian negotiating teams. That's a story in itself. Her most recent in a series of stories in The New Yorker on Iran and the talks is called Tehran's Promise, The Revolution's Midlife Crisis. You can find a link on our website, onpointradio.org. You can also find there a link to her blog. Robin Wright, it's great to have you back on Point.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you, as always.
There is so much I want to talk about here. Of course, the American peace never goes away, but we want to get inside Iran today. It might be good. This is such an incredible piece you've got out right now, and you've had such amazing access. I've got to think that, I mean, you've got unnamed sources here, but it sounds, reads to me as though it goes right to the top of the U.S. negotiating team. Give us the moments where this thing, whole thing, came closest to breaking down. Put us in the room as close as you can come, Robin.
Well, there were five times over the last 9 months when the tensions reached a point that were so severe that John Kerry was on the verge of suspending the conversation altogether. And it played out particularly in the crux of the crisis really was in May, after they had signed the interim accord in April, designing the framework for a deal. Then they had to negotiate all the details. And there was a moment when they met immediately after that that they realized that they interpreted the terms so differently. And the chief negotiator described it to me as a brutal session. And at one point, tensions became so severe that the Iranian foreign minister got up, walked around the room and said, I have to leave, and then went over to the side of the room, sat down on a chair, and put his head in his hands. Shortly thereafter, there was a moment when Secretary of State Kerry also lost it, and he became so angry with the Iranian delegation that he pounded his fist on the table. His pen went flying and hit the top Iranian negotiator, a man named Abbas Arashi. And so there were moments when this was really, really tough. There were a couple of times also in the final 19 days that played out in Vienna when both sides started shouting at each other so much that one aide had to come in from the corridors of the Coburg Palace and say that they could be heard outside and they ought to keep their voices down. So this has been a very tough negotiation for both sides, and it reflects the decades of distrust, animosity, suspicion, and the fact that they knew that this was epic diplomacy that could make or break not just the nuclear question, but the broader stakes of the Middle East, the fate of Iran's revolution, the Obama administration's foreign policy legacy, that this was not even – it was not just about one issue, even though that was what it was designed to do.
I want to talk about the fate of that revolution. You call it a revolution in middle age now with its own kind of erosion or diminishment over time. Broadly, though perhaps not among those still at the heart of it, but stick with the negotiations for a minute. When things got incredibly fraught, when John Kerry was apparently ready to walk away, he has said, Was this over big plank issues in the negotiation or over nuances that each side saw as critical to the bigger issues? Do you have a sense of where the sparks really flew, Robin?
They flew on different issues at different times. At one point in Geneva, the Iranians appeared to take one issue off the table that they had agreed to in the framework, and that was what led to one of the early confrontations. At other times, the U.S. changed the approach. They found that dealing issue by issue by issue, whether it was what the Iranians had to give up in the way of centrifuges or facilities or inspections, also what the Americans would promise in the way of sanctions, that that wasn't working. And so late in the day, the Americans offered the Iranians a package deal, what they jokingly call the grand bargain, because a reflection of a grand bargain offered 12 years ago that didn't go anyplace. And the Iranians felt that that was trying to amend the terms they'd agreed to, and that led to a shouting match, at which point the foreign minister of Iran shouted at the assembled six other countries, never threaten an Iranian. And word got out about this confrontation, and the Twitter handle, never threaten an Iranian, became very popular in describing the kind of tensions that were playing out inside the room.
Not least in Iran, where people are on Twitter and paying attention.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to see how the negotiations played out on Twitter. Ironically, you know, you'd think that with the world's six major powers and Iran in the room, that we would have seen an enormous number of leaks over a two-year period. And what's been astounding is the unity and the almost leak-proof nature of the negotiations. There were, by deduction, assumptions about what was being worked on. But the negotiators succeeded pretty much in keeping until the very end the flashpoints of the terms. But now the post-deal process is playing out on Twitter, too. And the White House announced today it has opened a new Twitter account just for the Iran deal. And the account is at the Iran deal. The Iranians have done something similar with their various accounts in English as well as in Farsi.
It wasn't all fraught moments and table pounding. There were breakthrough moments when, after all these decades of super frosty, icy relations, there were moments you describe here from your sources inside of something like real tenderness, not least on the 4th of July.
Yes, it was interesting that the Iranians and the other countries all ate separately. Now, remember, even though there were six major powers involved, the United States from an early stage took the lead and met more often than not one-on-one with the Iranians rather than with all the other countries, Britain, France, China, Germany, and Russia involved. Usually those foreign ministers would come in at the moment of agreement or the tail end of some set of negotiations. So it was often the Americans and the Iranians, and they would eat in separate dining rooms. And after 2 years, it became apparent that that it was slightly bizarre. And so on July 3rd, the Iranian foreign minister said to Kerry, would you join us for July 4th lunch? And Kerry said he'd be happy to, but the American delegation didn't think very much about it. But the Iranians actually went to a good bit of trouble and ordered Persian food from outside the hotel. And one of Kerry's top aides told me afterwards that the food was 10 times better than what they were eating among themselves.
Good moments. But, of course, it was the very next day where they had the big meltdown where everybody could hear them shouting all over the palace. Each side, as you report, and others, Robin, ended up complimenting the others on being great negotiators. Well, I don't know what to make of that. If each is trying to say that the other got the best deal, what's your sense of who ultimately emerges in this story as the most supple negotiator? If you boil that all the way down, the question may be too simple, but it's who won?
Do you know, it's such an important question, and I'm not sure that you can say either side won at the expense of the other. The whole idea here was to make sure that everybody came out feeling that they had won in some way, that the Iranians won some sanctions relief, while the six major powers hoped that they would win a sense that Iran's program would be contained for 10, 15, 20, 25 years in different aspects. And in that sense, both sides won some of what they wanted. Neither side won everything that they wanted. And that, at the end of the day, is what diplomacy is about. But that's also the reason that it will be deeply controversial, whether it's in Tehran or in Washington, because of the decades of mistrust, because of the meddling by both countries in each other's politics. Americans forget that in 1953, the CIA was engaged in a coup that ousted the first democratically elected prime minister from power and restored the Shah to the peacock throne. And at the same time, of course, the Iranians took over the U.S. embassy in 1979 and held 52 Americans hostage for 14 months, effectively ending the presidency of Jimmy Carter. So both sides have meddled in each other's politics and confronted each other on the security issues as well. So this is a fraught relationship that they've had to overcome in many ways.
We know how controversial it is in Washington and beyond these days in many quarters. What about Tehran? Just a few seconds before the break, but in a word, will Tehran ultimately accept this deal top to bottom?
I think it will try to mirror what the process plays out in Washington. There are over 200 Iranian members of parliament who have deep suspicions and skepticism. So President Rouhani and his foreign minister will have to do a selling job as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iran and the making of the Iran nuclear deal with Robin Wright, journalist, longtime Iran watcher. She's been behind the scenes in Tehran and Vienna. She's been publishing in depth in The New Yorker her latest piece, Tehran's Promise, The Revolution's Midlife Crisis. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins me today from Washington. Robin Wright reminds us there's a deep history here, the U.S. behind a coup against Iran's first democratically elected leader all the way back in the 1950s. By the 1970s, very, very palsy with the Shah of Iran as many Iranians turned against him. Here was President Jimmy Carter. This was New Year's Eve, 1977, state dinner held at the Tehran Palace of the Shah of Iran. Protests against the Shah swelling in the streets. In a year or so, he would be in exile. Here was the American president then, 1977, standing beside the Shah.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to your leadership, and to the respect and the admiration and love which your people give to you.
Island of stability? Nope. It's hard to listen to that. Within a couple of years, revolution fully in the streets, Americans taken hostage and all the rest. John Kerry saying Sunday on Face the Nation, CBS, that there are times when it's important to have diplomacy, negotiation, even with those who are not allies, in sort of equating Iran here with communist China, with the Soviet Union.
We're suspicious, which is why we negotiated a deal that is not based on trust at all. Everything that this deal is based on is on performance that could be verified, and that is critical. But look, you know, Ronald Reagan negotiated with the former Soviet Union. Richard Nixon negotiated with what was then known as Red China. You have to negotiate sometimes with people to make the world and your country safer.
What do Iranians think of this? Robin Wright has been in Iran. We'll ask her. Here was the sound on Vali Asr Street, main boulevard in Tehran, middle of the night after the nuclear deal with the United States and other world powers was finally done. And here, two young women in the Tehran crowd thanking their country's president and chief nuclear negotiator. Saying there in Farsi, I'm really happy about this great agreement that Dr. Zarif brought to us. Another woman saying, I feel a little lighter from all that tough work. Thank you, Dr. Rouhani. Thank you, Dr. Zarif. Robin Wright, you were there and there recently. Talked to us about, I don't know how to ask this exactly, because we're all sort of inured to these stories about how ordinary Iranians are cosmopolitan and open to the world and
not captives of the sort of hard-edged revolutionary mindset of some decades ago, and yet the leadership still seems to be. Help us understand all that.
Well, there's no question that the leadership remains committed to the revolution and its dogma, its rigidity. But it also is aware that the majority of Iranians and today the majority of voters have actually been born since the revolution. There was a huge baby boom after the 1979 upheaval as clerics called on women to breed an Islamic generation, and they did. And the population doubled in just over a decade. And it was at that point that the clerics recognized that they couldn't feed, clothe, house, educate, and eventually employ all these people who were also going to have the vote when they came of age. And so they introduced a population program, family planning program, that was among the most ambitious in the world. And it what it left, in effect, was a decade of a baby boom that is now mainstream. They're now 25 to 35, and they are huge in their numbers. Their interests are very much more global than local. The debate in Iran is no longer about the ideal Islamic state or the revolution. It's much more about how 21st century technology can change society. I spent a lot of time with young startup. There's an IT boom in Iran, much like the United States went through in the 1990s. And the focus is less on the kind of religious fervor that we associate with those early years of the revolution. Mm-hmm. When I remember being afraid to drive around at night because there were young vigilantes and supporters of the revolution who would stop cars to check if the women in the cars were married to the men in the cars, who would patrol the streets looking for women who wore lipstick or exposed their ankles. And today in Iran, I went to a park where close to midnight, there were thousands out picnicking, strolling with their kids, couples hand in hand, a concert at an arena performing local comedians. Hard to think of comedians in Iran, isn't it? Yeah. As well as kind of celebrities. Kids at a roller park that was part of the facility were on their skateboards and their rollerblades, dancing to Western music that was being broadcast. So it's, you know, quite a different generation than it was in 1979. And I think that there's this sense that among the clerics who are now in their, you know, late 50s, 60s, and 70s, that they have to accommodate in some form the noise on the street, and particularly the hardships that Iranians have endured as a result of both sanctions and the mismanagement of the last president, President Ahmadinejad.
But dig into that with us. I mean, it was painful to remember. I was in Tehran just a few months before Jimmy Carter gave that speech, fawning all over the Shah of Iran. And in a lifetime of lots of travel all over the world, I have never been in a setting where I felt more visceral anti-American sentiment than I did in Iran at that time. And the revolution was still a couple of years away. I was very young, and even so, I could feel it then. Now, you report very compellingly on this different culture, different attitude in the streets, but you also remind us hardliners in Tehran have a tight hold on all three branches of government, that, you know, those who would have been reformers, even at the very top level of former prime ministers and their immediate family, presidents under house arrest or in jail, their children under house arrest in jail, Iranians still monitored in many ways. Does it matter if there's a different, more open culture in the streets if, despite their age, you've still got this tight hold on the central levers of power?
Yes, Iran is actually a very frightening place when it comes to what we call the deep state, those invisible forces in the judiciary and in the intelligence community who not only go after anyone who dares to speak their mind freely in the press or in public, but also members of the government itself. Almost every president or prime minister in the early days has faced some kind of retribution. You have, as you pointed out, the former prime minister who saw the revolution through its first decade, a former speaker of parliament who've now been under house arrest since 2011. Both ran for the presidency in 2009, and after the reelection of Ahmadinejad, charged election fraud. They were charged with sedition. Former President Rafsanjani, again, one of Iran's wiliest politicians. Mm-hmm. His daughter and son have both been charged with crimes. His daughter was a member of parliament and a member of the Olympic Committee. His son, a prominent businessman, and he was sentenced this summer for corruption and propaganda against the regime. Even two vice presidents of President Ahmadinejad have been charged this year with a variety of actions against the state. No one seems to be immune. Former President Khatami, the popular reformist, is not able to travel outside the country, not able to be quoted by the press. His brother is a former deputy speaker of parliament, married to the granddaughter of Ayatollah Khomeini.
The revolutionary leader, no less.
Absolutely. And he can't leave the country. Both he and his wife, when they tried to run for parliament in 2004, were disqualified along with 2,000 others. That this is, we can't lose sight that this remains a revolutionary regime controlled by hardliners in which people feel deeply afraid of what they say in public and what they do. But it's also a dynamic society that has been willing repeatedly to challenge some of those forces, even if it means going to jail. And I have to say, there are thousands who have been imprisoned by this regime for daring to speak out. And I interviewed some of them on this trip.
You know this country as well as anyone. If this deal is in part a bet on a change in attitude and action by Iran in the years ahead, is that a good bet, Robin?
Well, it is a bet. And the question is, how do you change behavior in a society that you don't control? And ultimately, the Obama administration had to decide not just how do you confront the potential of a nuclear weapon, but how do you change the attitudes within the country? Do you do it most effectively through war or through diplomacy? And the Obama administration has bet on diplomacy. Now, the interesting thing is Iran faces an election in February for both its parliament and its assembly of experts, which controls the who is the supreme leader, has the capability of ousting him, though it's never happened. But there's a widespread sense that the assembly of experts that is elected next February will pick the next supreme leader because the current one is 76 and has suffered from prostate problems and had surgery last fall. There's a lot at stake. Just like the Iran deal plays out in an election season in Washington, so does it play out in an election season in Iran. And for many in Iran, there's a sense that it's the revolution that will be voted on in February, and that if President Rouhani managed to get a deal, that he stood to gain up to 25% more of the votes, or his supporters, the candidates he favored would win 25% more of the vote. That's according to hardline members of parliament I spoke with. That I think the hardliners are far more worried about the impact of lifting sanctions, helping their opposition, than they are about the nuclear deal itself. Everyone wanted sanctions relief. Even the hardliners I talked to wanted a nuclear deal. Of course, it's the issue of what the terms were. But this is a moment that a lot is at stake for this revolution at a time. The majority of the population is young. The majority of the revolutionaries are old. And the revolution itself is going through a midlife crisis.
We heard the sound of cheers in the street for the deal, but it didn't all go that way. And as acknowledged here, there's a little bit from an interview with the BBC last week, the Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif saying he wasn't surprised that some people in his country did not share his view that the deal was a great achievement. And you hear him refer right away back to that coup, U.S. and the U.K. against the first elected leader of Iran back in 1953. And then looking forward, here's the Iranian Foreign Minister last week.
There is a lot of mistrust, for good reason, of the way the West has treated us since 1953 onward. And unfortunately, we haven't had many positive episodes of cooperation. I hope this one will start to make a different impression in Iran, that people, in fact, can have an agreement with the West, and the West is going to respect that agreement, implement that agreement, and start to dent that wall of mistrust that exists between us.
That wall of mistrust that exists between us. Robin Wright has written about it all, the inside story of Vienna and Iran. It's in The New Yorker, Tehran's Promise, the Revolution's Midlife Crisis. Robin, a lot of callers for you. Lucia in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Lucia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, what do you know?
Well, mine is, Ms. Wright certainly is a professional and knows all the history. That's wonderful. But I lived in Iran for a number of years. I was there a couple of years when the Shah was there. I was teaching when the Ayatollah Khomeini was there for 3 years. And I was just back last year. So mine is more of a personal viewpoint, because I find here that Americans are so afraid of Iran and so afraid of Iranians. And my experience was so different from that. All the time, all those different times that I was in Iran, Iranians every day came up to me and said to me, "We want you to know we like America. We like Americans. We just don't like your foreign policy against Iran." And I think that we've kind of demonized them so badly that I'm worried that this might not go through, but I'm still very hopeful that it will.
Lucia, how do you square that with all the chants of death to America, the great Satan?
Well, you know, I ask about that because, of course, I was very offended by that. And I said, you know, every American is just not going to like to hear that. That is just so wrong. And what it explained to me that they don't literally mean death to America. That's the hyperbole, I don't know, the way they express language very colorfully. And what they mean is down with the policies that are, you know, hurting Iran and other countries, you know, the unfair things. When I went there in 1975, it took seven of their dollars to equal one of our dollars. When I was back there last year, it was 3,000 of their dollars to equal one of our dollars. I mean, they are suffering economic terrible, and we even keep medicines from going there.
Lucia, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. How do you square? You report something similar here about fairly warm attitudes in the street, and then Americans are very familiar, and they continue with the chant, death to America.
I went to Friday prayers in Iran, and they chanted death to America 20 times. I also went to the old U.S. embassy in Iran and got a tour, and from a young member of a paramilitary group affiliated with the Revolutionary Guards. And it's a spooky place because it is exactly as it was when it was taken over. All the machinery is still in the same place. The telex machine has its tape. There are passport offices that have the passport stamps out. It's almost as if everybody got up and went off for a coffee break, and the place is still as it was back in 1979. But death to America is still a problem, and they still shout it, and it's still as offensive as it was 36 years ago.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Iran and the making of the Iran nuclear deal with Robin Wright, longtime Iran watcher. You can join us. What do you want to know about Tehran, Iran today, about the deal? Talking with NPR's Steve Inskeep in an interview aired today, Secretary of State John Kerry defended the deal energetically, at times even sarcastically, to American and Israeli critics who said he had been too eager to strike a deal. Here's what he had to say.
I suppose we were so eager, that's why it took 4 years to negotiate. I mean, really, it's one of the dumbest criticisms I've ever heard in my life because it has no relationship to reality of what we were engaged in. President Obama, in almost every conversation, would say, remember, John, you can walk away.
You can walk away. And Kerry was emphatic in that interview with Steve Inskeep that the Iran deal makes the world safer, said if Congress votes it down in the next 60 days, it will be disastrous for the U.S. The U.S., he said, would be finished.
We're finished. I'm telling you, the U.S. will have lost all credibility. And if we then decided to use military, do you believe the United Nations will be with us? Do you think our European colleagues will support us? Not in your life. They'll say, you guys just walked away from something we spent 4 years negotiating with you. This will be a travesty. And Iran will begin enriching, and then you are right into conflict.
Of course, the denunciations have been fierce as well. Here was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, not mincing words, last week.
The leading international powers have bet our collective future on a deal with a foremost sponsor of international terrorism. They've gambled that in 10 years' time, Iran's terrorist regime will change while removing any incentive for it to do so.
Robin Wright is with us. Robin, lots of callers for you. Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Thanks for calling, Michael. You're on the air with Robin Wright.
Yes, just to that last point. I have been in general for improving relations and for the treaty, but looking at a lot of the press, and I spoke with a friend of mine who is Iranian and said that the power behind ultimately everything you see in Iran are the Revolutionary Guards. How do you reconcile what and President Obama said that this was not about the mischief that the Iranian guards have encouraged in the Middle East, but it's about the nuclear bomb. But how do you disentangle the two if, in fact, doing this deal will release a whole lot of cash that will be directly available to the guards to enhance whatever they've been doing in the Middle East, enhance the mischief, even while they're happy to wait for a nuclear option to come in 10, 15, 20 years?
I'd like you to define what you mean by mischief, Michael. It sounds like a light word, but of course it's not.
Hezbollah, Hamas, Yemen, the armies and actual attacks on U.S. interests in the Middle East and the rest of the world that have been maybe held back, checked by money available to them, but now will be totally emboldened and available with the coffers that come in from release of the sanctions.
Robin Wright, your thought.
It's a very important point. Iran will get relief of about $100 billion. That is their money from oil revenues, but has been trapped in foreign banks that were not eligible to actually give the money to Iran because of sanctions. And that will, over a phased period of time, be accessible to Iran. And, of course, everyone's concerned about how it will use this money, given its past support, particularly for Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen and beyond. The CIA released a report, and the Los Angeles Times did a good story about it this week, claiming that it does not believe that those funds will be used primarily or even the majority for nefarious activities, in part because President Rouhani has committed to revive the economy. He went on national television and admitted that the coffers in Iran were empty. But more importantly, Iran's nefarious forces in the Revolutionary Guards and something called the Quds Force, which is kind of their delta or SEALs of Iran, group of special forces that are operating in neighboring countries, has never had constraints because of budget. It's always been able to have whatever funds it wanted or needed. And so you have to balance it. I think it will be very closely monitored how this money is used. And, of course, it is a source of real concern. On your point about terrorism, yes, the State Department released a terrorism report in June, as these negotiations were playing out in Vienna, that cited Iran's support for all of these groups and its increased activities over the past year. There's no question. And the great problem was always disentangling whether it's terrorism or human rights and other issues from the nuclear negotiations. I think the Obama administration, and I'm not defending them, I'm just explaining their position, decided that the nuclear issue was one that was pressing, that Iran had gotten to the point that it had acquired a nuclear capability, and that this was the moment that it had to be stopped. And if this could be an avenue for dialogue or diplomacy, that then there were potentially down the road with time other issues they might be able to deal with. Ironically, Washington and Tehran actually do share an interest today in the biggest threat in the Middle East, and that's the Islamic State, which has already reconfigured the map of the Middle East in Iraq and Syria, changed the population dynamics with the flooding of refugees to Turkey, Jordan, even Egypt on a different continent, that this has become a real human tragedy, and that this is something that potentially they could talk about down the road.
One of our listeners, Tully, writes on Twitter, to that point, won't unfrozen Iranian assets, $100 billion is a lot of money, also benefit U.S. interests by likely being put to use fighting ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State?
Well, that's one of the possibilities. The Iranians in the early days of ISIS expansion into Iraq, when the United States said it wasn't prepared to provide new weapons to the Kurds in the north, for example, the Iranians went in very quickly within 24 hours and had military advisors on the ground, soon sent in some equipment. Now they're also involved with the Shiite militias in the south. The danger, of course, is that Iranian intervention in Iraq also exacerbates the sectarian divide between Sunnis and Shia. So there are both benefits to having somebody confronting the or advising government forces in Iraq, but there are also dangers. So,
of course, they swing right in behind Bashar al-Assad in Syria as well.
Yes.
Always complicated. Atlanta, Georgia, Ted is calling. Ted, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Robin, I love your books. I have lots of problems with this deal in so many different levels. The one thing that bothers me the most is the fact that we cannot trust the Iranian government. The Iranian people are not the problem. The Iranian government is the problem. And for us to make a deal with them, it's stabbing our friends, Saudi Arabia, Israel, in the back. What is going to hold them back?
Ted, if I may, you sound a little bit Iranian yourself to me. Are you, sir?
I am. I was born in Iran. I was there until 17 years, and I've never been back in 37 years. And the reason I have not been back is not because the Iranian people are not nice. The Iranian people are wonderful people. It's the Iranian government that cannot be trusted. I think it is extremely naive of anyone to think that we can compare Iran with China or Soviet Union. Those countries, they were already had arsenal. They are not religious fanatics. These people are crazy. I mean, can you imagine 1982, Iraq was very close to have nuclear capability. If Israel had not damaged it or demolished it, Syria, Libya, all these countries could have had it. And can you imagine if we had allowed them to have a nuclear capability? We literally handed it to Iranians on a silver platter in 10 years, 15 years, I don't care, 20 years. At some point, we are giving it to them on a silver platter.
Ted, we've got the view. Of course, the administration says we needed something to happen here, and if it comes up then, we can deal with it then. Robin, I guess the question that comes to me, and respond to Ted any way you like, but the question that comes to my mind is, how do you interpret what is the Iranian project today? What does the government, which Ted carves out from the rest of the population, what does it want?
Well, in terms of a nuclear program, you mean?
Nuclear program, but a nuclear program, presumably, even that is just a tool in service of some vision of what Iran's life in the world would be.
Well, one of the issues at the basic level is Iran's right to an enrichment program for a peaceful nuclear energy program. Iran, because of domestic consumption and its population surge, actually needs increasingly to use its oil for its own population. And at some point in the next 20, 25 years, there are estimates that it may run out of oil to export.
It's so also a huge natural gas reservoir under Iran, though.
Exactly.
You buy the energy need argument?
I think that every country, developing country, wants a basket of energy sources, and Iran is no different from that. It, as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, actually has a right to enrich, and the United States and the other five major powers have recognized that right. The question is, how do you restrict the program so it can't be used for at a higher level enrichment to fuel a nuclear weapon?
I mean, don't the centrifuge programs suggest a higher level goal?
They certainly do, and that's what the United States has said, and that's why it's cut back on the number of centrifuges, the level of enrichment. It's far too technical for most people to absorb, but it's down to a level, if they implement the deal, that will be the uranium will be useful only for a peaceful program. Now, look, there are obviously big issues, and everybody says you can't trust the Iranian government. The whole deal is premised on the fact that you can't trust the government. And that's why they have demanded that they comply in cutting back the number of facilities, cutting back on the number of centrifuges, cutting back on the stockpile of enriched uranium, and that they've built into the terms not just a decade of these things, but 15 years that they have to keep the stockpile down and the limit the number, the enrichment levels. They've got 20 years that all centrifuge programs will be monitored, and there'll be surveillance by cameras, by human beings. That for 25 years they will monitor all uranium mines and mills. These are the places where they get the uranium that then is going to be enriched. And that permanently, that Iran's declared facilities and any suspect facility will be monitored by the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency. So it has different layers of inspections for different amounts of time. There's no question that whether they're Republicans or Democrats, no one trusts the Iranians, and that's why they're demanding they take all these steps. Yes, no question that Israel and the Gulf states particularly feel that this allows way too much. Both parts of the Middle East demanded no enrichment. The problem is that the Iranians had acquired the capability, the knowledge, it was too late. If the United States had done this 12 years ago, that was a possibility. But they had made 19, almost 20,000 centrifuges. And eliminating all of them was just a non-starter. There wouldn't have been a deal to begin with. There are lots of imperfections in this deal. Diplomacy is always imperfect. The deals the United States negotiated with the Soviet Union didn't do everything the United States wanted then either. When we dealt with China, it was hard to remember, but the Chinese, as we were negotiating the opening of diplomatic relations with Beijing, was actually increasing aid to the North Vietnamese in one of the bloodiest wars of the 20th century. So, you have to begin someplace, and I think that's the calculation of the Obama administration. Whether the Iranians will comply is, still to be seen.
And a very big deal. One more call, if I may. Aviva in Miami, Florida. Aviva, you're on. Our time is short.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to mention that I'm a new generation from Iran. I live in Miami for 10 years. Sorry. I just want to say that I support this deal very much as a new generation in Iran. We had so much hard time because of the sanctions, and all the Iranians deserve this deal. I know that you cannot trust the regime, but all the people, general people, love Americans. This is so true. They live with the American culture. They know all of the presidents in the United States. Even they know more history in the United States than United States people. And they burning this flag. This is just hardliners. They They paid the money to do that. This is not the real Iranian people. If you just pay attention to the people that went back to Iran, like the reporters, they just mentioned that Iranian people in general, just in the street people, they love Americans.
Aviva, I appreciate your call very much. You give a kind of a witness to what Robin Wright sees on the streets there. At the same time, there's the regime. Robin, as we speak today, the president has been demanding release of the Americans held in Iran, in Iranian prisons. We've just got a minute here. What about that issue? Why are they in there? Why, if Tehran is open to change, why not let them go?
Well, I'm not sure Iran is open to change. I think that that this is a critical issue, and the violations of human rights, this is one that the United States will continue to impose sanctions, both for terrorism and for human rights abuses. There are three Iranian-Americans and a former FBI agent who've been missing or detained now for years. And this will reflect the deep divisions that will remain even if this nuclear deal is implemented.
Robin Wright, the depth and nuance of your reporting is always a gift to us. We're grateful for it and for your time with us today. Thank you very much. Let's talk again as this whole story unfolds. Thanks for coming, Robin.
Thank you, Tom.
Robin Wright, see her latest piece in The New Yorker. You can link to it from our website. It is Tehran's Promise, the Revolution's Midlife Crisis, on the behind-the-scenes reporting from Vienna and life today in Iran, political and otherwise. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.